Mark chapter 12, beginning with verse 38. And he said unto them in his doctrine, he being Jesus, beware of the scribes which love to go in long clothing and love salutations in the marketplaces, and the chief seats in the synagogues, and the uppermost rooms at feasts, which devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers, these shall receive greater damnation. Now, these are the guys that Jesus had to deal with so much of the time, and he didn't deal with them because they supported him. He dealt with them because they opposed him. They just didn't care much for any of the things that he said. They were his enemies. So he told his disciples in verse 38 to beware of these. And he listed some of the things that they needed to be careful about. And whatever they needed to be careful about, it's probably a good idea that we be careful about as well. They were pretentious. They loved appearances and making things look just right and causing people or leading people to think more highly of them than what they might have otherwise thought if they did not involve themselves with these kinds of things that Jesus is listing. They love to greet people in the marketplace and to be greeted by people and have themselves called rabbi and things like that. They love the chief seats in the synagogue because if you're up at the front and everybody else is out here, they can see you. And they can understand that they're not sitting up where you are, that you are more privileged than they are, and so that's a good deal, you know. They like that. They like the uppermost rooms at feasts. Well, obviously the same kind of reason. But he said they devour widows' houses. And for a pretense, they're just pretending, they make long prayers. And they made those publicly, you know, out in various places around the temple and in the street corners. And Jesus said these shall receive greater damnation. So these are those of whom Jesus is speaking that were the leadership of his day. And then the story changes. Because now he's not with those guys particularly and dealing with the hypocrisy that is so blatant and in his face. Verse 41, Jesus said over against the treasury. He's in the temple. This is the last week of the Lord's life. And he beheld how the people cast money into the treasury. That's okay to do that. And many that were rich cast in much. Well, they did. This was in the court of the women where the various pots, there were seven or eight pots there that they kept for casting money in. And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. He called unto him his disciples and saith unto them, verily I say unto you that this poor widow hath cast more in than they all, which have cast into the treasury. For all they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even her living. So here comes the widow. And she does what she does. And nobody notices. You know, two mites, those were just little old bitty, cheap, worthless coins that they used during Jesus' day. Couldn't buy a dead sparrow with two farthings or two mites. But you know, she got something that despite all of their education, all of their tradition, all of their presumptive power, these leaders that he was addressing in verses 38 and 39 and 40, she got something that they didn't get. She was aware of things of which they were not aware. And it was all their loss. Chapter 13, verse 1, as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples saith unto him, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here? And Jesus answering said unto him, seest thou these great buildings? There shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Alright, so Jesus has been in the temple. He's encountered these guys that are constantly harassing and haranguing him. And he's dealt with them as best anybody could deal with them. He went into the court, the temple of the women, and he sat over there by the pots where people were casting in money. And he was just watching. And you know how these guys used to throw their money in. They were wealthy and they had a bunch. And they would sound trumpets before them. So they could announce their coming. So everybody would say, oh, they're going to task. Let's go see what they're throwing in. And here came this woman to cast in her two mites, which Jesus said represented more than altogether what everyone else had cast in.
It had been a hard week for Jesus. Know that.
He had set his face, Luke records in his gospel, to go to Jerusalem. And that language conveys the thought wasn't going to be his favorite place to go. And it wasn't going to be his favorite time to go there. But there were certain things that were awaiting him in Jerusalem that he knew he needed to address. He had to be there for the Feast of the Passover, because he was going to be the Paschal Lamb. And so he came to Jerusalem, and we know the triumphant entry, but as he drew close to Jerusalem on top of the hill of the Mount of Olives and he looked down at the city,
the gospel writers tell us that Jesus wept over that city, and he wept, "Oh Jerusalem, oh Jerusalem, thou that stonest the prophets and killest those that are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy chickens under my wings, but you would not."
And so he wept for that. It was emotionally tearing for him. You understood that as he looked down at the city of Jerusalem, he saw it from all the different ages
in which men had lived there.
Back when it was just a little wide spot in the road, there wasn't any Jerusalem, it was Salem. But he saw Salem as clearly as he saw Jerusalem on that day. And he saw Melchizedek, the prophet, who was offering sacrifices in Salem.
And Melchizedek was pleasing to God. He was a man of faith when there were no scriptures around to give him faith.
And he saw Abraham bring his son Isaac up there before the temple was ever built and before there was any wall around the city, and offer him on that rock there on the top of Mount Moriah.
And he called to mind those instances. And all through the centuries of time of God's dealings in that city.
This was God's city.
This was His city. And they were going to reject Him.
He knew exactly what was going to happen during the course of that week. He went down to the temple and he encountered those who were buying and selling like this was a marketplace or outside of Walmart somewhere.
Money exchangers and those that sold doves. And he overturned the tables, used a whip of some kind or another, and chased them out of that's a big area to chase out of, if you look at the plan of the temple. It was a huge courtyard. And he chased those guys out and stood in the middle of that courtyard and dared anybody to come back in. This was the temple, God's holy place. So much of what he faced this week was discouraging. So many words spoken against him. So many men taking his words and twisting his words and using them against him. So many men mocking his miracles and saying he's nothing but an uneducated carpenter. No, Jesus was like us. He experienced what we have experienced and continue to experience. You've known discouragement.
You've known what it's like when you try to do the right kind of thing and it just sort of all falls in on you.
Your motives are right,
the thing that you've done is right, and yet for that right that you have done, you suffer criticism. Folks are talking about you.
You are rejected.
You know that kind of discouragement and how it is. Jesus knew exactly that kind of discouragement. It's sometimes hard to keep on doing good when your doing of good is not really appreciated. When it seems like for the good that you do, you receive only evil for the good that you do, it's hard to keep on doing that good. I mean, we're just human folks. Jesus was just human folks.
So there he's got him. Yes, he was that as well. But the discouragement that you and I can come to know is the same discouragement that he knew
at various stages of his life. And he needed the help of God. You remember the worst came when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane here just shortly after this occurrence here in Mark chapter 12.
And he prayed to God that the cup might pass from him. If there's any way in the world, and there was not, he was disheartened. He was discouraged. He sweat, as it were, great drops of blood falling to the ground.
The Lord sent angels, or God sent angels, to strengthen him on that occasion. Here on this occasion that occurred just a couple of days before, and he's dealing with the leadership, and things are bad, and
He sends someone else.
I believe in the providence of God. I believe in the special providence of God, that He's watching over the circumstances and situations of our life, that when we are discouraged and when we are disheartened, He knows that.
And God sends people. Have you ever looked for those people when they came? Did you ever notice it after they came and think, I wonder if God sent them? God sends people to us at various stages of our life that say to us the things that we need to hear, that remind us of things that we have seemingly forgotten.
He sent the Canaanite woman to Jesus, if you remember, in Matthew chapter 15. And she was a Gentile lady. And Jesus, once again in Matthew 15, had been dealing with those whose religion was all worn on their shirt sleeves, who had nothing in their heart toward God. In vain they do worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. They go through all of this pretense stuff, he said in Matthew 15. God's going to pluck them up by the roots, he said.
And it was discouraging working around those guys, but God sent a Canaanite woman to it. She had a daughter that was possessed with a demon. And she came to Jesus and said, Lord, will you help me? Will you please help me? And Jesus' response to her was, no, I don't think so. And so she asked him again, well, Lord, please, will you just do something? And he said, no. He said, it's not appropriate. This is not the situation or the setting for her. It's not meet to take the children's meat and give it to the dogs, he said. Now that was kind of insulting from our viewpoint. So he turned again down a third time. The disciples came to him and said, would you send her away? Would you just simply tell her plainly she needs to go? She fell down and worshipped. Listen, you knew from the outset Jesus was going to help her. This woman was persistent. Jesus was just kind of checking about, well, what kind of faith does she really have? Does she have a faith that gives up? Is it one that just first obstacle you meet, you let go of? She had a faith that persisted despite the obstacles that were before her. And Jesus said, after he healed the daughter, he said, guys, he called the disciples, he said, guys, listen, pay attention to what you've seen today. He said, I've not found faith like this in all of Israel. He sent a Canaanite woman, a Gentile woman, to encourage Jesus after that time. On another occasion, Matthew chapter 8, he sent a centurion, a Roman Gentile centurion, in the city of Capernaum. When again he'd been dealing, butting heads with those that were opposed to him, and he was discouraged, and so he sent the centurion to Jesus saying, Master, you know, I have a servant that is dying. Would you come and help me? Jesus said, I'll come. And the centurion backed up from that and said, really, you don't need to come. He said, I know what it's like to have authority. I have men under me, and I tell them to go, and they go, and to do this, and they do that. And you just speak the word, Lord, and my servant will be healed. Isn't that something? The kind of faith in that Roman centurion's heart. Jesus said again, no faith like this in all of Israel. And he encouraged him. Here on this occasion, God sent Jesus this woman to help him. Because, you know, you had to be, I mean, he's coming close to the cross. And I don't know, maybe the human in him caused him to say, I don't know whether it's really worth it. You know, he shed all of these tears, he's gone through all of this agony. But is humanity really worth dying for? I mean, if they're like these guys in verse 38, 39, and 40, then no, they're not. But if they're like this woman who gave her two mites, then yes, they are. And so Jesus was encouraged to continue on in his journey to fulfill his mission. I question myself sometimes. If I make Jesus wonder whether his sacrifice on the cross was really worth it. Inconsistencies. So often faith seems to be shallow. Wavering here and there. Let's be the kind of people
live the kinds of lives in faith that will cause Jesus to have no regrets for the price that He paid to redeem us.
So He points this lady out in verse 43 to the disciples. He specifically called them together. He got them in a holy hut. And He said, guys, do you see the lady walking across right there? That one right there, walking that one.
And they said, we see her, Lord. Do you know what she did? And they didn't know what she did. No one else knew what she did. God always knows what you do. If you tell yourself sometime, I don't make any difference in the world, nobody notices me anyway. God always notices, and yes, you do make a difference. And so He pointed her out to the disciples and said, this is what she did. She's a widow. She doesn't have anything now. She did have two mites, and she gave all of that in. She has no job. She has no husband to care for her. She understood that when Jesus said, except a man forsake all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple, in Luke chapter 14. She had a handle on that. The leadership there. They never got the point. And so He held this example up to His disciples, and He thought, okay, they've seen it, they've listened, this is good. They'll learn from this. I read into chapter 13 because we noticed that they didn't learn from it. I mean, they may have said to each other, you know, wasn't that interesting what that woman did? I mean, she's to be commended for doing what she did, but they didn't really get it. And I know that because of what comes in those next two verses. They were leaving the temple. And one of His disciples, I don't know which one was, said to Him this, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. I mean, Jesus was thrilled with the two mites that the widow had given, and these guys were thrilled with the size of the rocks in the temple. How far apart are they in the understanding of what it means to be a disciple of Christ? To be a son of God? They were fascinated by the stones. He was fascinated by the worthless gift of this widow.
Now, the stones were something. I mean, you know, they weren't... Everybody that came to the temple always pointed out the stones. And to any Gentile that came wandering through, they pointed out the stones. And
if you go on a tour over there today, they'll
point out the stones.
And they're notable stones. Don and I, when we went to Egypt, we visited the pyramids and walked up inside the pyramid. We saw some big rocks there, folks, that they had taken and they'd hewn out and set into those pyramids. Big old stones that they'd worked with. We got to the Temple Mount area of Jerusalem. We went to the Wailing Wall, and then we
took a left and went down underneath that area to see really the foundational stones of all of that. They even have a special name for those stones. They're the Ashlar Stones. And we stood by one and walked the length of that thing.
Unimaginable. The size of that stone. 44 feet long. That's 12 yards. If you measure all 12 yards, if you think about a football field, the 10-yard line to the goal line, plus 2 yards, that's the length of that stone. It was 15 foot wide. So if you go from that wall over there and you come over almost to the end of that pew right there, you have 15 feet wide. Or maybe a little more than that. It was 11 and a half feet high. So if you go up to that ceiling up there, you got 11 and a half foot high. So you got this huge, massive stone that had been carved out and had been carried from the quarry to put in that place in Jerusalem to serve as a foundation for the temple and for the walls. They streamed permanence. You know, when Titus came to the city, he did as Jesus said. Jesus said, you see these, you see all of this? There'll not be one stone left upon another. Well, they tore the stones down. Not all of them. This was, you know, wasn't intended to be exactly precise language here. The Wailing Wall is still there, as you know. But what if the language is simply the language of destruction? He destroyed the thing. He didn't move these rocks, folks.
They'd been there for centuries before Jesus even came onto this earth, and they would continue to be there until today, and probably until this world is destroyed. They will occupy their place. But Jesus wasn't impressed with the stones and the accomplishment of the people who had hewed those stones out and who had moved them and set them into place. Jesus was thrilled by this woman. Does what counts with him count with us? I ask myself that question. When I start thinking about, you know, something I want or how I think things ought to be, and I ask myself from time to time, what does the Lord think about that? Is that anything that would count with him? Or is it not? The disciples, for all their miracle witnessing, for all of their teaching, hearing, and they still weren't there yet. They would get there, but they weren't there yet. They were still thinking, of course, about earthly stuff. They were still thinking that that temple would stand forever. I mean, because of the size of the stones, it's just going to be here always. They were wondering in the back of their minds, you know, when Jesus does finally establish his kingdom and he becomes the king of Israel and reigns over all of this, wonder if we'll get to live in Herod's palace. You know, it was up there on the hill, not too far from the temple, and it was a splendid thing. Gracious sakes. Courts and pools and magnificent. Wonder if we'll get to live there. Or maybe on top of Masada, where he had another palace. Or maybe in Caesarea, where he had another palace. Or wonder which ones of those we'll have. They still didn't get it, folks. When we come to Acts chapter 1, one of the first questions they asked of Jesus before his ascension was, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? Are we going to get that stuff now, Lord? What they didn't understand, this woman understood. What counts with us doesn't always count with God. The way this world measures what is important is not necessarily the way the Lord measures what is important. Well, how long have you been going to church? Oh, since before I can remember. We always went to church. Every time that the doors were open, when we were assembling at Washburn and I was a kid, we held services on Sunday morning, and that was all. We didn't have any preacher. Didn't meet Sunday night or Wednesday night. We met Sunday morning. But we were there every Sunday morning. And when we finally did begin to have a Sunday evening service, we were there Sunday morning and Sunday evening. And later on, years down the road, when we began to have a midweek service, we were there Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday. I've always gone to church, you know. I know about this church stuff, just like you. Songs that we sing, that we've sung for generations. We have pews, and we have song books, and we have more modern stuff now than we used to have back then. We have assemblies where we pray and we share in this communion and we read and study our Bibles together. And yeah, I know about church. But do I really understand what this is all about? Or do I think that somehow or another it's about this building? That it's about, you know, an hour a week. Or maybe if I'm really pious, 2 hours a week or something like that, and then live my life however I choose to live my life. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this. Are you ready? Are you listening? That we are to take care of the widows and the orphans in their affliction. And that we are to keep ourselves unspotted from the world. That's what James said in James 1:27. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially to those that are of the household of faith. That's what Paul said to the churches in Galatia. He said this in Galatians chapter 5. Do we understand what church is? The fruit of the Spirit is love, verse 22, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. Am I pursuing those things? Am I seeing those things? Or am all I seeing just buildings in a service time with an obligation to fulfill? The disciples didn't see what they should have. The Jewish leadership certainly didn't see what they should have been seeing. They didn't catch what this woman caught. They didn't understand what this woman understood. And that's a shame. Our faith must change us. We cannot be the people who we once were, continuing to do the things that we once did. Our faith must change us. In 2 Corinthians, the 3rd chapter, this is what Paul said. 4th chapter, rather. For our light affliction, verse 17, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. So it's where we're looking, and it's what we're seeing. Are we seeing what we ought to be seeing? And back up one chapter in the book of 2 Corinthians, to the 3rd chapter. And he says in verse 18, but we all, every one of us, all of us, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. We must be changed as that woman was changed. To see things we otherwise wouldn't see, to hear things that we wouldn't otherwise hear, to be people that we wouldn't otherwise be. But we live so much of our lives consumed with just stuff, you know, getting and spending and having. You understand that God never told you to have anything. Not materially. He never commanded you to have anything. To Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, when He created all of this, He said, "Now I want you to have all of this." No, He said, well, He gave it to them, of course, to tend and to eat off of. But He wasn't interested in what they had. He was interested in what they were. We concentrate so much on having, and it's the devil that leads us to that. I mean, in the beginning in Genesis, when he tempted Eve to partake of the tree, he questioned Adam and Eve, you know, is there something here that you don't have? You sure you're not missing out on something? Look around a little bit and see, what is it you don't have? And the only thing Eve could find, well, the fruit of that tree. Don't have any of that. Well, don't you think you should have some? And so they had some. But not by the commandment of God. Specifically against the commandment of God, they had some. If all I'm interested in as I live in this world is what I can have rather than what I am to be, then I'm still missing it all. Yes, God has commanded us to have faith. Oh, most assuredly, have faith. But that's spiritual stuff. But it's interested in us in having faith because what faith can lead us to become, what we will be once we are people of faith, He's always been concerned with our being rather than just our having. So we read over and over again in Scripture of the reality of that. You remember Paul to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6. He said, listen, godliness with contentment, chapter 6, verse 6, is great gain. Well, we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, yeah, we have that. Let us be there with content. Understanding what we have, God challenges us in the direction of what we should be. And it's important that we be just that. Philippians, the 4th chapter. Paul says in verse 11, I speak in respect of want. Paul didn't have everything that everybody else had. There were some things that he was still in need of that he didn't have. And so he said, I'm talking to you a little bit about that. And he talked to him about some things that he didn't have. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to... And you can finish the verse. But it was a learning process for Paul. God wanted him to be something, not want something, to be content. So as we live life in this world, let's think, you know, let's pay attention to who we are to be. We are to be children of God. And if children, then heirs. If so be that we have shared in the suffering of Christ, that we may inherit with Him. Let's be those kinds of people. The farmer in the parable Jesus told measured his person by what he had, and so he had big crops, and he had little barns, and he needed bigger barns to store all of his big crops. And he took a look at all that he had, and he said, so you've got a bunch, you have a lot. The Lord said to him, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be that you have? They're a good question for that farmer to answer and for us to answer as well. If we gain the whole world, Jesus said in Matthew chapter 26, you can quote, or 16, y'all can quote the verse. And yet we lose our own soul. What are we promised? What do we really have when we have it all? Only that which is perishing. Let's try to avoid the trap of the devil in every way that he encourages us to place our emphasis on things that we can have rather than on what we are to be. Let us be the sons of God in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation if we're called to be so, but let us be the sons of God here in this world. Let us be His church with everything biblically that is meant by the concept of the body of Christ. Let us be that. Let us be this widow who didn't measure the value of her life in dollars and cents, but who measured the value of her life in faith. Jesus instructed the disciples in Matthew 15:22. He just said, guys, He kept it real simple. Have faith in God. That's the challenge before all of us today. Have faith in God. We're going to sing a song of invitation. If you're here and not a Christian, then this is your time to come. This is the opportunity in repentance of sin and confession of your faith. We will be happy to baptize you into Christ today. Or if you need our prayers as God's child, we will assist with that as well. You come home, we stand and sing. First and last answer.